The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Gibbons presiding.
Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is case number 80481, Jensen versus District Court. We have Ms. Dolson representing the petitioner, Ms. Vaccarino representing the real party in interest. And my understanding, Ms. Vaccarino is on the telephone. Ms. Vaccarino, are you there? Okay,
yes,
great.
Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, and Ms. Dolson, you may proceed. Do you wish to reserve some time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd wish to reserve 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, okay. And you'll have a little beep. You'll hear and you'll see the clock on the video, and just go ahead and stop speaking at that time or conclude your remarks, and then you can reserve that time and we'll go forward. So go ahead and proceed. I might, as a preliminary comments, I know we've gotten some motions in here and different proceedings filed recently with the court, and there was some confusion whether the case had been resolved, the issue that we were talking about, then the court's kind of unsure what's going on here, but that was one reason we wanted to hear it today and find out if whatever our involvement is, we want to get it taken care of. We don't want to delay the case any further, but if either side wants to update us on that through the course of your presentation, please feel free to do so. Okay, Ms. Dolson, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Sabrina Dolson, and I represent the petitioner, Shane Jensen, in this matter. The essential questions before the court today are whether the district court arbitrarily and capriciously disqualified the Dickerson-Karachuny Law Group from representing the petitioner, Shane Jensen, whether the district court abused its discretion in awarding Caroline her attorney's fees and costs, and whether this matter should be remanded to a different district court judge. Now, this court should reverse and vacate the district court's order disqualifying the Dickerson-Karachuny Law Group because the district court failed to properly apply the correct Nevada rules of professional conduct and failed to properly analyze the rules it did apply. This court should also reverse and vacate the district court's order awarding Caroline her attorney's fees and costs because the district court abuses discretion by awarding Caroline her attorney's fees without a legal basis as punishment to Shane for opposing the motion to disqualify. The district court also failed to analyze the Brunzell factors as required by Miller v. Wilfong. Lastly, this court should remand this matter to a different district court judge, given a reasonable person knowing all the facts of this matter would harbor reasonable doubt of the judge's impartiality. Regarding the first issue, the district court should have applied Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct 2.4a and 1.12a to the facts of this matter. Rule 2.4a provides that a lawyer serves as a third-party neutral when he or she assists two or more persons who are not clients of the lawyer in resolving a dispute. Serving as a mediator qualifies as serving as a third-party neutral.
Now, the fact that Ms. Dolson, I appreciate that on the mediator piece, but when there was also a request or perhaps an option to have him do the joint petition as well, wouldn't that one have put it over into 1.18, and then we're talking about prospective client analysis?
In the mediation agreement, it's very clear that Mr. Dickerson was going to discuss whether or not they wanted to possibly hire him to draft those documents after the mediation had been completed. It was not the reason the parties initially contacted Mr. Dickerson was for the purpose of mediation, and sure, that was only an issue to be discussed later. The facts of the matter demonstrated that the parties contacted Mr. Dickerson for the purposes of mediation. On June 25th, 2014, Mr. Dickerson had a conversation with Shane alone in which Shane informed Mr. Dickerson that he was contacting him because he and his wife wanted to engage Mr. Dickerson for possibly providing mediation services. On July 2nd, 2014, Mr. Dickerson then had a telephone conference with both Shane and Caroline present. Mr. Dickerson explained to them the mediation process and the documents and the information that he would need in order to proceed through mediation. Now, Caroline testified that there was a private conversation between her and Mr. Dickerson during this July 2nd, 2014 conference. However, there's nothing that precludes a mediator from having a potential mediator from engaging in conversations with either party without the other party present, as Mr. Philip Petit testified. Mr. Philip Petit is a assistant bar counsel and has been so for 18 years. Mr. Daniel Hoagie, who is the chief bar counsel, also testified there's not even a rule of professional conduct that would apply or creates any duty towards prospective mediation clients. Following that July 2nd, 2014 telephone conference, Mr. Dickerson then drafted up a mediation engagement agreement, which he emailed to both Shane and Caroline the same day. Now, the mediation engagement agreement is very clear on the first page. In bold and italics, it states that it's for the terms of engagement for mediation. Mediation is mentioned 22 times in those six pages of that agreement. On July 10th, 2014, Caroline then contacted Mr. Dickerson and confirmed her understanding that they were contacting Mr. Dickerson for mediation services. In this email, Caroline informs Mr. Dickerson that she and Shane are working towards trying to figure out a few more issues that they want to make sure that they're able to resolve in mediation, and they would like more time to pay the mediation retainer fee. Caroline also indicated to Mr. Dickerson that she intended to hire Marshall Willick and his associate Trevor Creel so she could obtain independent advice regarding her military pension. This again confirmed the party's understanding that they were initially only contacting Mr. Dickerson for mediation services. All of these emails were copied upon Shane. Mr. Dickerson then next heard from Shane on July 13, 2014. Shane informed Mr. Dickerson that the parties had pretty much reached agreements on every issue. Mr. Dickerson did not respond to this email. The parties never signed or returned the mediation engagement agreement. The retainer fee was never paid, and there was never any mediation. Caroline then ultimately did hire Marshall Willick, and he represented her in the divorce. He drafted her complaint for divorce, and the party stipulated decree of divorce. And Shane represented himself.
What do we do, Ms. Dolson, with the findings on page 4 and 5 that the judge signed, Judge Pomerantz, that there were discussions between the two of them about custody, along with the myriad of financial issues, that they are post-divorce issues, and that she found the wife to be credible over Mr. Dickerson, basically. What do we do as appellate courts with those types of findings?
Well, according to the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct, even if the district, or if you were to take the district court's findings that Caroline was credible over Mr. Dickerson as true, the court still did not properly apply the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.18, if Caroline was in fact a prospective client. Because Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.18, provides that a lawyer shall not represent a client with interests materially adverse to a prospective client in the same or a substantially related matter if that lawyer obtained information from the prospective client that could be significantly harmful. Now, the district court never found that Mr. Dickerson actually acquired confidential information from Caroline. Disqualification is not warranted absent proof of reasonable probability that counsel actually acquired confidential information from the prospective client. Now, the requirement that an attorney actually acquire confidential information is not a presumption. It's a factual matter that the district court must decide. And absent a finding that the attorney actually acquired confidential information, then it follows that the attorney should not be disqualified. So assuming that Caroline was credible, she testified at court that she did not provide any confidential information to Mr. Dickerson.
Do you have a Caroline record testified, site? Wait, do you have a record site for that, that she did not provide? Do you have a record site for that?
What I
you
do.
Just said,
yes.
Where you said so she provided testimony that there was no confidential information?
Yes, there is volume 6, page 1313 through 1314, and 1302 through 1304.
Well, Ms. Dolson, wasn't the testimony that she didn't tell Dickerson anything that Shane didn't know? But
correct.
She conveyed to Mr. Dickerson that she felt strongly, it was how strongly she felt about those issues, not that those issues were not known to Shane.
Correct. Yes, Caroline testified. The district court and Mr. Caraccioni both went over with Caroline, line by line, every piece of information that Caroline testified that she provided to Mr. Dickerson. And for each piece of information, they both asked her on two different occasions, if Shane was aware of that information. And Caroline testified that Shane knew all pieces of information that she provided to Mr. Dickerson. So Mr. Hoagie testified also that typically information could be considered to be significantly harmful, with the caveat that if it's known to the other party, then it likely would not be significantly harmful. Given Caroline testified that Shane was aware of all information that she provided to Mr. Dickerson, Mr. Dickerson never actually acquired any confidential information from Caroline.
What significance do you place on the fact that this occurred, that the raising the conflict occurred 18 months after he had already been represented and motions had been filed, many years after the original matters had been decided? This is post-divorce proceedings. What significance do you place on that, and whether the info was significantly harmful, and if the judge erred in making that finding?
We do believe that the judge erred in making that finding, because any information that is provided after the last custody order is not relevant in determining whether custody and support should be modified. So here the underlying motions concern whether child custody and whether child support should be modified. And in McMonigal v. McMonigal, this court held that any information provided prior to the last custody order cannot be considered when determining whether child custody and support should be modified. So given this information was provided a year before the last custody order, which the parties entered into their decree of divorce in 2014, and then they modified it in July 2015. So everything prior to July 2015 is completely irrelevant to the facts before the court today.
Were you reserving time, Ms. Dolson?
I did. I did reserve 2 minutes.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Based on the foregoing, it is very clear that even if Caroline could be considered a prospective client of Mr. Dickerson, given that no actual privileged or confidential information was provided to him, there could be no significant harm to her in these current proceedings. Now, the district court should have balanced the parties' competing interests, Shane's right to counsel of his choice, and the risk of inadvertent disclosure of confidential information, which we see here that there was no risk to Caroline given there was no confidential information that was passed. A disqualification is an extreme remedy that should not be imposed lightly, and courts should only disqualify with extreme reluctance, and this did not occur here. In addition, the district court also abuses discretion in awarding Caroline her attorney's fees and costs. The court's award was not supported by sufficient reasoning or findings. The court referenced NRS 18.0102B. And pursuant to that statute, the court can award attorney's fees to a prevailing party if the court finds that the opposing party maintained or brought their claim or opposition without reasonable ground or to harass the prevailing party. Now, the district court did not make any such finding that Shane's opposition was without reasonable ground or to harass Caroline. Rather, the district court relied solely upon the fact that she had been in Ms. Vaccarino's shoes on this one and had been faced with a similar dilemma in the past. The district court also stated that, and confirmed in the order, that she had an off-the-record conversation with both counsel for the parties. And during that conversation, she informed Mr. Caraccioni at that time that he should simply refer the matter out to another attorney and not to tarnish the reputation of the Dickerson Caraccioni Law Group. Given the court's award was not based on any on NRS 18.010, and the fact that the court's award pursuant to Halbrook Leaning in Love was inappropriate, given those cases just provide that the court has continuing jurisdiction to award attorney's fees when there's an appropriate post-judgment motion relating to support or child custody. And given the fact that the district court did not consider any of the Brunzell factors as is required by Miller v. Wilfong, the district court's order was an abuse of discretion, and this court should reverse and vacate the award of attorney's fees. Lastly, this court should also remand this matter to a different district court judge. A reasonable person, knowing all of the facts, would harbor reasonable doubts about the judge's impartiality. Now, the test for whether a judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned is objective and presents a question of law, such that the court should exercise its independent judgment of the disputed facts. Now here, it was very clear that the judge had prejudged the issue, given the off-the-record conversation with the counsel prior to even hearing evidence at the evidentiary hearing, the court basically suggested that Shane should drop his opposition and just refer the matter out to a different attorney.
If we were to agree with you, why do you think we should send it to another judge? Even if she was wrong on the law or it needed to be reversed, what makes you think she couldn't be fair and impartial even on a reversed case?
Because her decision shows that it was based on an extrajudicial source. She basically punished Shane for not following her advice, which was given off of the record. Her finding that Mr. Dickerson was not credible because it would not be unlikely for him to forget facts, or that Shane was not credible just because he had more to lose in the proceedings, demonstrates actual bias and prejudice. I think any reasonable person looking at the facts of the matter could reasonably question whether or not the judge could remain impartial.
Well, we have criminal cases which involve post-conviction relief and ineffective assistance of counsel. And attorneys testify to what they do and what they didn't do all the time. Are you saying that based on her findings here that Dickerson couldn't practice in that court because now there's actual bias because of what he did in one case?
With respect to this case, I think it's very clear that the judge harbors at least a very an actual bias towards Shane. I mean, there's no reason besides he had more to lose in the proceedings that the court determined that he was not credible. I see that my time is up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Dolson. We asked you some questions here at the end, so we'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal. And, Elizabeth, if you'd add 1 additional minute to Ms. Vaccarino's time as well to balance that out. Ms. Vaccarino, so you'll have 16 minutes for your argument, so you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Patricia Vaccarino, bar number 5157, appearing on behalf of Caroline Jensen, the real party in interest. Sabrina Dolson has already laid out for you the issues that they feel warranted this court's immediate intervention. Unfortunately, this motion was filed 16 months ago in April 2019, when for the first time, when looking for discovery back from when they first received the divorce, she put together that Bob Dickerson was in fact the Bob Dickerson that goes along with Joe Carasone. So the concern that we have is throughout the course of the district court proceedings and attempting, which we're required to do under 8th District Court Rule 5, attempt resolution, we made earnest attempts. We asked for all of the records that Mr. Dickerson and Mr. Carasone's law office would have had all the way back to 2014. That request was made in or about April 2019, but it was ignored for a while. And in fact, if you look at Rule 1.18, and even, you know, because their position has changed, that those documents, any documents that he retained or any file that he has, she would have been entitled to that. And as we wrote in our paperwork, some of the paperwork that was marked and admitted as exhibits wasn't provided until 2 days before the trial that started in July.
Ms. Vaccarino, I have a question as to what I had asked her. Do you admit that, did your client testify that the discussions after the mediation, that those were not, did she testify that there was nothing confidential that was said to Mr. Dickerson?
That was not her exact testimony. So she, of course, testified on direct, and she testified on cross-examination. Then she testified from direct questioning by the court. And on one direct question from the court, it was asked, are you sure that everything you told Mr. Dickerson, your husband already knew? And her response was, maybe or probably, I don't recall. However, let me call your attention to my answer of my, to fully answer this question for you. So starting at page 42 of our answer to the petition that was filed on February 25th of this year, we have appendix quotes from volume 4, 5, and 6. A lot of volumes for just a disqualification issue. Between pages 860 and 1,257. And I call your attention to the following testimony. I asked Caroline, tell the court why you felt that was not, you said, quote, legally kosher, and tell the court why you believe you shared with Bob Dickerson made you feel this way. And her answer was, I didn't feel it was appropriate because I felt like I provided him substantial personal information. I was extremely uncomfortable talking about it in front of my ex-husband. And also, he had time alone. She was referring to her husband then, Shane, had time alone with Mr. Dickerson on the phone, and I wanted that time to myself as well. So I had a private conversation with him for 20 to 30 minutes. And then I asked during that conversation, did you only give him information or did you receive information back as well? It was objected to as leading. It was sustained. I asked again, tell us what else happened during that conversation as what has Mr. Dickerson specifically told you? Her answer is specific. I talked about my ex-husband's resignation in lieu of getting court-martialed. It had to do with significant shady dealings, for lack of a better word, scams. And Caroline was referring to what could have been a felony. He was stealing from the military and taking items back, using coupons and getting full payback.
I'm sorry. It's really hard to understand you when you talk really fast because we can't see you. And it's just, I'm missing half of what you're saying because you're talking super fast. So can you slow it down just a bit so that you can explain to us what she said that was confidential again? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's just, I'm missing what you're saying through this, tele thing that we're doing. I'm sorry about that.
No, thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. So what she was conveying in court in July of 2019 is that she did, in fact, have a private conversation where she shared with Bob certain goals she had about custody and certain concerns she had about husband's character, like shady dealings, what she called scams, for a lack of a better word, she said. She recently found that her ex-husband at the time.
Okay, I don't want to get into scurrilous back and forth about those
well,
facts
the point
that, aren't
was,
that are not that Ms. Vaccarino,
okay.
That aren't germane to the issue here. So
well, the question
you're saying,
was.
I'm not done with the question.
I'm sorry.
So I'm going to have to ask you to hold for a second. Why should we credit the court's order that says that Dickerson could have received info? Doesn't the court need to find, A, that he did in fact get that information? Also, how would that information be significantly harmful now, as opposed to back when she talked about it, and what is the proper standard that we should be looking at, 1.18, prospective client, or mediation?
Thank you. So let's talk about these two lonely words, quote-unquote, could have received. Unfortunately, there were two proposed findings of fact for the judge that were submitted. And when she gave her decision from the bench, she used the word could twice, because you'll see the word could in the rule 1.18, which we do think is the one that is absolutely applicable to this set of facts, as Bar Counsel Hoagie agreed. So did the judge, is this a case where you would say, I'm concerned about that could have, and she didn't make a definitive finding, where you'd say, I want a remand. I want a definitive filing that this record is replete with the fact that Caroline shared personal things and asked about strategy from Bob Dickerson about if she should proceed with fighting for custody or fighting child support and talking about her military retirement, because the reason why it's not spurious that she wanted advice from Bob separately, and she didn't want her husband to know this, and she didn't want to upset him because she wanted a settlement, but she wanted to know whether or not she had any case that she would lose his share of retirement because of his bad conduct, and if that bad conduct would have any effect on how a court would assess him being a good co-parent or being able to trust.
Okay.
Even though the words of the district court judge may not be as precise as the court might want, the record is replete with the correct result based upon accurate facts.
So, Ms. Vaccarino, I'll hold you just 1 second. So that is all information that was pre the determination on custody and those other issues. How does that pre-finding information affect the current proceeding? How does it how is it substantially significantly harmful in this current proceeding?
This is why. Rule 1.18 states why. And not only that, Your Honor, when we spoke to bar counsel and the bar counsel came to court, they referred it. It didn't get admitted into the record, but obviously for purposes of argument, we had a proposed Exhibit 8, which Van Hoge, right before the proceeding.
If it's not in the record, I don't want to hear about it.
Well, I'd like to explain to you as far as argument when you said to me, when you look at the commentary, when you call bar counsel to vet an issue, they refer you oftentimes to the commentary, if there's none local, from the American Bar Association. Now, the model rule differs just a little bit. However, the comments about this rule number are important. It doesn't matter how long ago the consultation was. The rule, even our Nevada rule, very clear, and you read it, the rule does not say that it, unless this happened 7 years ago or unless there was an intervening order and she had a new attorney or he represented himself. The rule says that a person becomes a prospective client with the lawyer about the possibility of forming client-lawyer relationship with respect to a matter. And what attorneys have to do, and this is the part that this court and the district court had a hard time with, and I don't think you can excuse it. Rule 1.18 says that you have to, if you furnish information to the client, like the fee contract, at page, the bottom three of this rule says, if the information furnished to the client includes the fee contract, and it did, the top of each page of the contract shall be marked, quote, sample in all caps, in red ink, in type size, one size larger than the largest type used in the contract, and the words do not sign shall appear. Nowhere in this rule is there an exception. Nowhere does it say that, oh, if McMonigal applies and it's an old rule, you can't hear that evidence. It says you shall not unless you get informed consent. So what happened was we received advice that said, you know, this isn't a safe case. Better safe than sorry. And not only that, the model rules that discuss this rule and Dan Hoge and other, Mr. Carlin and even Mr. Patty when we called him before we came to court basically said that, well, Mr. Patty wasn't clear on this, but the other two attorneys for the bar said that the perspective of whether or not you're a prospective client for an attorney is from the reasonable litigant, not from attorney Patricia Vaccarino or attorney Dolphin or attorney Dickerson. It's what a reasonable litigant would think. So if you look at this course of negotiation, as you said, when you asked the first question, Justice, when you asked the question, what about this fee agreement? Isn't it a hybrid? And that is what made this a difficult case for Judge Pomerantz. I'll tell you why. Because look at the opposition to the district court motion to disqualify. It didn't say anything about, oh, yeah, so what? She was a prospective client. We asked for her consent. She declined to give it, so we filed a motion. They didn't do that. Even the testimony of Bob Dickerson in the record says that no one made the decision. But Joe Carasone took the case, and they knew that there was a Jensen file for both Caroline and Shane. They knew their record, and they never wrote me, because I was her attorney, saying, hey, we don't think there's a conflict of interest, but to be safe, we want this consent and waiver signed. So Mr. Patty, the reason why Judge Pomerantz wanted additional testimony is because she saw the facts, and there's nothing illegal about being asked to go back in chambers, and on the record, everyone say we're fine with that. And then now try to come to the Supreme Court and argue and tell what happened in chambers and say that created bias. That's the most artificial argument I've ever heard. I mean, that was consented to. And, you know, in fact, Judge Pomerantz, according to the Yellow Cab taxi case, could have been granted the motion for disqualification without evidentiary proceedings, and that could have been upheld upon writ or a possible appeal. So what I'm saying is, the time that passed, the intervening information, doesn't affect the mandate of what duties are owed from attorneys to their clients or their prospective clients. And moreover, what's most troubling is on the first day in court, back in late 2017, early 2018, Judge Steele had the case. And Joe Carasone was in court, and so was Sabrina, and so was I, my client. And I raised a potential bias issue open court because a long, long time ago, 13, 14 years, I dated Bob Dickerson. I know how he conducts work, and I didn't want anyone to think that because he was my former boyfriend for a brief period of time, that that would be make me not be a zealous and worthy advocate for Caroline. And I think I don't. There's no law, there's no ethical rule that I had disclosed that in the record. But wouldn't that have been the perfect time to say, oh, and by the way, Bob Dickerson spoke to both of these people, but there's no conflict. So all of these things are concerns. Now let's look at how Joe Carasone's opposition to the request for disqualification has changed, and that's what shows how weak the case is. At first, they were adamant to me. They were adamant to everyone that there is no conflict of interest because he was a third-party neutral. That's all he acted as. And when I tried to refer them to this rule and said, that's not what this paperwork says. Now, then they went as far as saying, well, that's fine. He didn't get any confidential information. Judge Pomerantz didn't agree. Now they tried to tell you, the Supreme Court and Judge Pomerantz, that Caroline's a fraud because, as you well know, you can't second-guess unless there's a clearly reversible error that only Judge Pomerantz gets to judge the credibility of these witnesses. And what's astonishing to my client, because she's only a layperson again, it's her perspective, that the other side didn't oppose you reviewing our opposition to that strong word fraud, but the Supreme Court has declined to hear our response to that after asking them to weigh in. So my client was concerned that you're left with this belief that she somehow not only, you know, did the court do something wrong, but now they have a whole new theory that she made up a whole lie. If you would look at our letters, these conversations, there's letters that went on and on between June all the way through July 13th and beyond, and they maybe all have been mistaken about the exact date, July 2nd, that Caroline had that private, what she believed was legal advice and a consultation about a substantially related matter. And she can be significantly harmed because Bob forever knows that strategy. He knows how emotional mom is about custody. He knows the most important is a good schedule and getting the proper support. And what do you know? Here we are, 4 years later, 5, 6 years later now, she can't get the right support out of Shane Jensen, who, as you see in the appendix, makes $250,000 a year. She was still serving the military as a Thunderbird very well. She just retired recently, pending this litigation, this Supreme Court litigation. And he was using his financial superiority to keep the child support away from her. The substantially related issue. The same issue that Caroline confided incredibly to Bob about, that he's not going to want to pay me. And he gets $1,000 in my retirement. How is that fair? He knew all her strategies. So the rule, we're not supposed to second guess the litigant. That's a reasonable perspective, especially when Caroline had lots of paperwork. And look at the July 13th letter from Shane, Exhibit 7 that was admitted, and it's in your appendix. Shane wrote and said, we want you both to be our attorney. Thank you.
Ms. Vaccarino, let me, the time did run out, but I think we understood your point in response to Justice Stiglitz's question. Does either of the justices have any more questions for Ms. Vaccarino?
No.
No, hearing none. Okay, thank you, Ms. Vaccarino. We'll go ahead to back to Ms. Dolson for her rebuttal, and she has 1 minute for her rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think I would like to just point out that Ms. Vaccarino really did not touch on the fact that Caroline was given the opportunity twice. Both the district court and Mr. Carabcioni both went through each piece of information she testified that she provided to Mr. Dickerson, and twice she was asked if Shane was aware of such information, and she confirmed over and over with each piece of information that Shane was aware of that. The district court judge asked her, was there anything you told Mr. Dickerson was a concern to you in the July 2nd conversation with Mr. Dickerson? Was there anything you told him that Mr. Jensen did not know? And Caroline responded, I don't recall, I don't think so. Caroline testified to information that she claims that she told Mr. Dickerson concerning her Shane's resignation from the military, Caroline's military retirement, and the fact that she did not want to share it with Shane, Caroline and Shane's work schedules at that time, and Caroline's upcoming non-flying assignments in Washington, D.C. None of these issues could be significantly harmful to her now. There's nothing that could be possibly relevant.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dolson. Thank you very much. Thank you, both attorneys, for participating with us today in our substitute way of doing our oral arguments. We appreciate both your cooperation. We will take the case under submission, and we realize it's somewhat time-sensitive with the issues. So with that in mind, we'll do our best to get it out as quick as reasonably possible then. But thank you both for your participation.